Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 10, delivered on September 24, 2015. The title of this lecture is Debt Instruments.
Today, Debt Instruments. This is a cleanup lecture covering the some details of Chapter 5 and some information beyond just Chapter 5. What's in the textbook anyway. And through the course of this lecture, you'll see some practical information that will be of use to you in your personal and professional lives, as well as get some definitions and some details about debt. Madam, I have just purchased from you an asset-backed note for you to purchase a vehicular asset. Can you put that in plain English for me? You issued... Wait, what? I know, right? It's even worse for me because I got to face all of you. You just have to face my sorry ass. I'll put it another way. You issued and I purchased an asset-backed note.
So you're giving me money to buy a vehicle with.
So say it in plain English.
Yeah, you're giving me money. You're loaning me money. So I
lending,
buy.
Not loaning. God, that pisses me off. Anyway.
You know what I'm saying.
No, I don't. Concentrate, woman. Make it even simpler. Make it even simpler.
Even simpler than that?
Yes. Someone just said it. Someone just said it. No, you just took out a car loan.
Yeah.
And I was the one who lent you the money. You just took out a car loan. I lent you the money. It was a car loan because it was asset-backed. That's an important thing, which means, will the interest rate be very high or maybe a little lower? Yeah, because the default premium won't be as severe because there's something that I can claim. It's still going to be a little nudge because as soon as you drive it off the lot, it's going to lose some value. But at least I'm partially covered on it. So that helps right there. And it's a note, so clearly it's probably somewhere in range of 36 to 60 months and all of that. And you were the issuer, so that means you're the borrower. You got to remember that because I'll do that on the first exam. I'm going to telegraph one of my punches. One of the essay questions is going to have to do with what it means to be the issuer of a debt instrument. The issuer in plain language is the borrower. And the purchaser in plain language is the lender. That's important, and I'll hit you with some kind of a question, sort of like that. I'll say, put it in plain English. I'll describe some kind of complex financial transaction, and oftentimes in finance, actually in almost any business field, we can say things in very complicated ways, but what we're saying is something that's actually known and easily understood if you just said it in plain English. But we have to be a little more technical in our business terminology. Now, I'm going to describe two different kinds of debt instruments. There are all kinds of ways you can chop up and divide debt instruments. One way that we could divide them up into those that are mortgage and those that are debenture. Now, I'm sure you have heard, well, I got a mortgage to buy a house. Well, actually, what you did was you issued a bond, but some bonds have an attachment, essentially like an annex, that attaches an asset to performance on the debt instrument. A mortgage simply means that there's an attachment. There are covenants that are more than just debt. The covenants have to do with a way that repayment can happen if the normal course of payments doesn't happen. Now, if I say debenture, that means it's uncollateralized. It's naked. In some terminology in finance, we use the word naked to describe something that is that just doesn't have anything behind it. Surprisingly, a great deal of the action where you buy and sell, and there are limits on it, but in a lot of cases, these financial wizards do pure naked transactions. They don't have what they are selling. They don't have the money for what they're buying. So in the real world, this concept of debenture, of naked, is all around out there. It's kind of scary when you think about how trillions of dollars just isn't there in assets that are being backed, whatever. Mortgage, debenture. That's one way you can divide them up. Now, most of the loans that you would get, well, I shouldn't say that. Credit cards would be, which would they be? Mortgage or debenture? Yeah, because they're not backed. And that's why the interest rates on credit cards are so high, is because there's no asset backing. That default premium is just a monster on a credit card debt. Just a monster. But at the same time, car loan, you'll get your home loan. And there are certain other kinds of loans that you can get too that are essentially this asset-backed loan. Now, here's an interesting thing, is that if a company goes tap city, it cannot pay its debt in a timely manner, it can't make its interest payments or something like that, then there will be an order of liquidation. The company, the debt holders, are just going to simply go to court and say, court, please liquidate this company and we get our money from the liquidation. Now, there is an incentive for debt holders not to do that, because any liquidation is going to hurt like hell. You're not going to get all that much money. But the mortgage-backed, the asset-backed debt would come first. Liquidation, okay, and in some cases, a bond issue would actually have a thing. This is what you get. Liquidate, and this is what you get. But one way or the other, the asset-backed will get theirs first. And then from there, you will get debentures. In order, you've got senior subordinated, junior subordinated. There's all kinds of layers of that, and I'll get into that later in the course. But I'm introducing you to the concept now. And on down the road, everyone will get a claim, but in debt, the claims are prioritized by the seniority, but first by whether they are backed by an asset or not. So down the road, those who simply the company owed them a few bucks for they hadn't paid an invoice, they're probably not going to see anything by the time that game is over. An interesting court case arose, and I'm pretty sure it's been at least 10 years ago, where a company, it was a retail catalog company, and they were just beginning to try to probe the online environment back then, but it was mostly catalog, very big company. It couldn't pay its debts, its bondholders, their coupon. Just right away, the bondholder just swooped in, took it to court. The company tried to do a reorg, negotiate with the bondholders to come to work through the debt, renegotiate. Didn't work out. And so essentially it was just company gets liquidated, end of the story. Now, interestingly enough, in this case, there were bondholders. There were a few mortgage-backed bondholders. Then there were some debenture holders, more than a few debenture holders. And there were a lot of companies that just simply had money that bills that defunct company owed. And then there were all of these people who had ordered stuff from the catalog, but they hadn't gotten it yet. Now, the oddest thing was that when the bankruptcy court brought the debt holders in, and they said, all right, obviously, well, we're liquidating, you get yours first, And there was one sad little lawyer representing all of these people who had put in orders with this company. The inventory was there in the warehouse. It had just never been shipped to them. And he said, Your Honor, we should like to have our shit. Please send it out. It belongs to them. And the strangest thing was that the court said, no. You don't get, they are so far down, that inventory will be liquidated and that will be allocated up down the chain from the senior to the junior subordinated, junior subordinated, all that. There won't be any left for those people. They can't have, first of all, they can't have their stuff. And second of all, they won't get any money from liquidation because they're so far down on the list. Now, that was a surprising and troubling. It's an example of why we always are worried in business. And in any kind of business, but especially in finance, when you get courts involved where the judges and their advisors don't have deep fundamental training, learning, education. Clearly, these consumers had an asset-backed claim. That's a very high-priority claim. They had a thing that they had bought. But the court just didn't understand that, didn't grasp that. And, of course, the suits from the big bondholders, those guys wearing suits from the big bondholders, they were going to mention the fact, yeah, I guess they do, because, you know, they do have an asset-backed bill. It's a very short-term debt. Didn't work out. And it never went to the Supreme Court, partly because this lawyer didn't have the money to front to do that, because the consumers didn't really have the money for it. And even at that, the Supreme Court has been very pro-business, pro-wealth kind of Supreme Court for a number of years now. It wouldn't have flown there either. And so at least at the current present time, it is not constitutional law. It was just at a bankruptcy court level. So it doesn't have that force of if the Supreme Court had agreed with this. And so we're going to have to wait for some long time, maybe in the future, to have a higher court rule on this in a more reasonable way. But there you go. That's something that's out there to consider. Now, in terms of debt, when you have long-term, when a company issues long-term debt, let's say it issues $100 million, 8%, 30-year, a very typical kind of animal, Well, all it's going to pay every year for 30 years is, it's going to pay $8 million. That's all it's going to do for 30 years. That is unlike consumer debt, where you're paying, this is, in other words, all corporate and government bonds do is service the bond, service the debt through the life of the bond. And then out here at year 30, there's one last coupon payment and the $100 million. Now, in other words, there's a balloon at the end, a kicker at the end. And you can do those on your calculator. They're actually, by old-fashioned formulas and tables, they are a real pain in the butt to do. I mean, they take, you have to go work back and forth because you don't have just a present value of a future expected cash flow. You have it smooth, and then there's this plop at the end, so the normal formulas don't work. But calculators can do it in the blink of an eye. So bless those financial calculators we have this day. But anyway, okay, so this is a normal animal. The thing, though, is the bondholders are not stupid. Every bond issued by a corporation has all of these covenants and contracts. As the originating lenders, a syndicate of lenders, trust funds, insurance companies, investment structures of all kinds, they're going to make sure that a lot of things are in place. One thing, interestingly enough, when you start issuing bonds as a corporation, And I found this out firsthand. I had never been told this until I saw it in the negotiations to set up a bond. The bondholders are going to have in the contract itself, in the covenants, they're going to say, have things like, well, you can't issue dividends, or you can issue only certain size of dividends. In other words, they want a lot of reinvestment in the company to keep the company growing and the cash flow growing. They're going to say, well, certain types of projects you're not going to engage in, or you're going to engage in them only with our permission. And they're going to, essentially, the corporation becomes the bondholder's bitch and makes it coffee whenever it wants. In fact, it is so intense that in a bondholder agreement, in this covenants of the contract of a bond, they appoint their own trustee who oversees, has a great deal of power within the corporation to oversee planning, especially strategic planning, to make sure that the bondholders' interest is being watched after. Now, this is good to the extent that when you were 16, you were crazy. You were out driving around like a blind trout every night, drunk, wasted, and all kinds of other things. Now, yep, that was me. No, it wasn't. You were a lame ass. You were in the basement eating Cheetos playing World of Warcraft. But the deal here is that in a younger corporation, this is like a parent. It's almost like you answer to me. But interestingly enough, as a corporation proceeds forward, these kinds of bond agreements can become almost like a deterrent. You might want to try something new. You might want to innovate. You might want to take a risk. Bondholders don't like risk. No, we don't want you to do that risky stuff. But in order for you to grow, in order for you to explore, and in order for you to make your shareholders happier by increasing their wealth through investment projects that have high ROIs, and in order to get them dividends that make them happy, you might want to do things that bond covenant, that bond contract says you cannot do. And that's a reason that it's not talked about so much in academic. Well, why do companies not issue bonds? You get all this against leverage. Well, one of the subtle reasons, if you actually work in this business, is you know that some companies really don't want bondholders watching over their shoulder. Do you want mom looking over your shoulder every night now? No, especially if, you know, you're with someone you really like in a compromising position and your mom leans over, Ted, what are you doing? Or when you are out and someone says, try this, and you really want to try it, even though you know that there's a problem with it because two of your friends are already over on the side twitching and you want to join them. And there's another one over there, he's listening to Justin Bieber. That's bad, man, but you want to try it so you can say you did it. Understand that there are some, especially higher tech companies, you'll see them with debt levels that are actually surprisingly low. Even though they could gain leverage and increase their ROI, increase their ROE maybe, return on equity, but they don't do it because they don't want that anchor around them in their innovative period. Honest, the same thing, even with a small company like mine, I could get a line of credit that would allow me to expand my inventory, do shows much farther away, and have a much better looking display area. But they have rules. They have things. I have to talk to them. I have to tell them my plans. I have to show them where I'm going to spend the money. I don't want to show them where I spend the money because I might spend it on some cheeseburgers. And then they'd bitch at me. So just know that bonds are great because you get money, other people's money. But the price of that is that it restricts your business decision making in ways that might be adverse in the long run to the strategic plan that you have in mind. Now, another thing, interestingly enough, let me get to this $100 million. In the covenants, they're not going to let you just hope to have $100 million in 30 years. They're going to require that you put money into a sinking fund over the life of the debt instrument. Now, it could be, okay, every year for 30 years, you put in $3 million or $2,500,000 with compounding interest, something like that. Oftentimes, from what I've seen realistically, the sinking fund will load toward the front. You'll put in more in the early years just to make sure that you've got it covered for the later years. That is problematic for some companies because their cash flow is not so great in the early years. And you'll see all kinds of different patterns, sinking funds that start out high and then decline to get to $100 million at the date of maturity. Others that are low and then they build and then they go low again. There are all kinds of these, but they're in the contract, and the trustee for the bond, the bondholder's trustee over the issue is going to keep an eye on making sure the fund is there. An alternative that I've seen that's actually kind of popular, interestingly enough, and there are all kinds of twists that can be done on this that are really cool. If you take a higher level investment finance course from me, I can show you some ways that you can make some interesting money this way. But there's another one called a serial bond. A serial bond, you need $100 million. But what you do is you issue, let's say, $20 million of it every year for 5 years. So that over 30 years, at 30 years, you owe back only $20 million. At 31 years, you owe back another $20 million. You see how the trick works? You're actually staggering out the bond series so that in no year are you getting at the in the tail, are you getting whacked with the whole $100 million or whatever it is. Serial bonds come in all kinds of flavors and varieties, and there are tricks that you can play with them. I might even have you give you an optional article so you can read some of the tricks that companies can do with these. And it makes for us, it makes for a more interesting situation. It it satisfies that sinking fund provision a little better, in an alternate way, I should say. But it also, interestingly enough, it makes it so that these $20 million plops can be more digestible by a capital market. In other words, instead of looking for a syndicate that can handle $100 million right now, by the way, when I say the word syndicate, there will be a primary investment banking house. They will set up the deal, and they'll say, all right, we're going to buy this bond series from you, and then we'll sell it to our clients. But the primary house will have, after it has agreed, it will then set up a syndicate of other investment banking houses that will handle part of the issue for their book. And so that's what I mean by a syndicate. But where was I going with? Oh, so, but a syndicate might not be really excited about a whole $100 million in 1 year. But $20 million in 1 year, well, that's a lot easier for the syndicate to handle. And again, when in a firm underwriting, whether it's stocks or bonds, there's the company that needs money. What it does is it finds an investment banking house. Investment banks, this is what they do. In the old days, they were highly specialized. After Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in 1999, any bank could do this, basically, which scares the hell out of you when your home bank is playing in these kinds of capital markets, but that's the way it's been for over 15 years now. Anyway, the investment bank. So essentially, the company will issue the bond, and the investment bank will pay them the money for it. And then what will happen is that that bond, the investment bank will have a syndicate of other investment banks, some small, some as large, maybe even larger than the primary investment bank. And what they'll do is the bond, little pieces of the bond, will be handed off to these. And then all of these cats will sell the pieces to their investment clients. You might be a very rich matron of the arts. You have scads of money. I'm one of these investment houses. Hi, would you like to buy about $1 million in bonds from Acme Corporation? I might encourage you to do that. You might be an insurance company and they invest in very long-term bonds. And I might call you and say, well, we've got this issue. Would you like to pick up some of it? One thing that you should be sure of is that if an investment house calls you and says that we've got an issue, let's say of stock, and it's an IPO, and we'd like to have you buy some of it, get in on this IPO, what would you, in your judgment, should be your reaction to that? You. We're talking about you, and I am investment banking house. Hi. I would sure like to have you get in on the Facebook IPO. And I've got a chance for you to get 1,000 shares at $40 a share. No, let's say at $50 a share. What should you say? No. Why? Do you know why? Or did you just say that because I want people to be assholes like I am?
IPOs are pretty risky.
Well, no, they're very risky. But more importantly, you see, Mr. Rich client here, I've already taken care of him. He's getting the IPO at $40, okay? You're getting it at $40. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sell it to you, a very big block, and then a whole group of you suckers out there, I'm going to immediately call you and flip it at $50 a share. You say, I get to be in the Facebook IPO? Oh boy, I get candy tonight. I've already flipped it from 40 to 50, made him happy with me because I want him to be happy with me because he's a very rich person. I don't give a rat's ass what happens to you. I'm going to get you $50 a share stock and possibly you. Well, I can't get it at 50, but I might be able to pull some at 53. It's getting really rough out there. This is such a popular IPO. Oh, I'm sorry. I can do 60 on this. Yeah, see, the price went to 50 and then it went to 53, and I mean, it's got a bullet on it for 60. Look, you want it right now? You got to say yes right now. Come on, what do you say? And I just keep, well, the hell with you. But the point there is, you see, I am actually causing the price to drive up by creating artificial demand. I am making you a very happy rich man who's going to send me a bottle of great single malt for the holidays. And all that kind of stuff. I've spread you, let's say, 1 million shares on $10 a share pop. I've gotten you $10 million, and I've gotten you at 50, 53, 60, and then when the capital markets figure out that this is crap, they're going to tail that stock down, and you're going to be stuck with stuff that was actually maybe not even worth $40 a share when I got it to you. That's how it works. It's a classic flip. Don't ever join in an IPO unless you're a very rich, powerful person, because otherwise, if you're not the head of the donkey, you're the ass of the donkey. Okay? Just some advice from someone who used to do this for a living. Okay. All kinds of different animals out there. Asset-backed instruments and debentures. All kinds. Interesting story I'll tell you about an asset-backed bond. If you were to Google this topic, you wouldn't find anything really in Google or Yahoo search engines or Bing about what I'm going to tell you about here. You will find it in European websites, and there's, for my advanced financial theory and practice students, I assign them an article where they read about gold bonds from World War II. Now, if you type in gold bonds in Google, you'll see German gold bonds pre-World War II. I'm talking about something else that's kind of a creepy, odd chapter in American financial history. And I actually saw in my lifetime like an echo from it. But it worked like this. After World War II just absolutely leveled Europe. I mean, you had cities that were literally, the whole city was rubble. Factories were wiped out from France to Italy, to the Netherlands, to Germany. I mean, it was just a catastrophic mess. The whole continent was bombed back, literally in some cases, nearly back to the Stone Age. So our policy in that era was, okay, we've learned our lesson. You don't just defeat a country and just walk away from that country and all the countries around it that were occupied. We learned that lesson from World War I. We left the whole of Europe a complete mess, and that's what brought the rise of the Nazis and their crap. So after World War II, we said, we are going to fix this. We are the United States. We kicked ass, and now we're going to rebuild that ass. So they did. We spent a ton of money in the post-World War period. It was called part of it was the Marshall Plan. You might have heard about it in high school or something like that. But we spent a lot. I mean, it was just unbelievable amounts of money. So as our government would typically do, it issued bonds to raise the money to do these projects. And it figured that, well, yeah, this is going to cost us a lot of money because we'll have to pay back the bonds with interest. But at the same time, with a Europe that is rebuilt and with a lot of investment by American corporations in the new Europe, we'll get our money back in a growing economy, global economy that's integrated, a world that is not fighting with each other. It's just fighting on the marketplace battlefield instead of real killing fields. Well, one of the ideas that came about was, why don't we back a bunch of these bonds that we're issuing to raise money for the Marshall Plan? Why don't we back them with gold? I mean, real, actual gold, that you could get your money back in gold if you invest in these. And, of course, that would have an incredibly high level of confidence. Anyone who could afford it would want to buy a gold bond because, I mean, you got your money back in gold. And that was the way we used to do things. We backed a lot of our securities. Even our money was backed with silver and gold. But these bonds, same thing. We'll just back these with the gold in Fort Knox. Well, there was a problem with how that worked out because it turned out that the biggest buyers of those bonds were the damn rich European families that we had protected during World War II. They bought those bonds by the truckload. And then they waited for the bonds to come due. And then they claimed their gold. You see, the thing, though, is, remember I said those were European investors. So the gold flowed out of Fort Knox and our other gold repositories into the banks of Europe. We nearly wiped out our gold reserves. I mean, literally, we still to this day haven't recovered quite all the way from, it was just like a funnel. When those bonds came due, well, those investors didn't want American dollars. They said, just pay us in the gold that's backing this bond. And so we just got our gold reserves were just drained. Interestingly, you'll read about this. The investment sites, finance classes in Europe, they'll talk about this. It was not a great thing that happened. It was a disaster from the American perspective. But somehow we just kind of don't talk about it too much anymore. Now, I knew about it because I was in advanced grad school and all that kind of stuff. I knew about these bonds, and I thought, well, those are kind of a cool thing. I got in the 90s, I got into consulting. After I started a brokerage house, and the state of Ohio told me to shut down my brokerage house, or they'd make me the wife of a very large group of men at a state prison. Because it was a big scandal. I wasn't part of it, but they shut down all the penny stock houses. So I started doing consulting. Now, in that era, as a consultant, I was a whore. I would do anything for a dollar. And a lot of it was crap stuff. You'd hear, yeah, well, we heard that there's this guy has these diamonds over in Russia and he wants to sell them. Can you broker a deal? A lot of it was completely phony. Once in a while, something was legit. warehouse full of medical equipment. There's some buyers in a clan in Siberia that wants to buy the medical equipment. You could broker those. You make a few thou on those. Once in a while, something like a couple of old Soviet-era tanks, a few of those, you could broker those out to some South American dictatorship so they could kill people with them. It was nice. It was good work when it was. But then one day, I got a call from a real heavy player. He had helped, he'd gotten me some interesting stuff. Some of it was crap, some of it was good. His name was Paul, and he was in New York City. He said, "Hey, Alan, I got this old couple. They need someone to help them. No one can help them. I promise you that when they come to your office, you're not going to believe what you see." Okay. Times are tough. I haven't had a consulting gig in almost, I haven't had a broker chain in about maybe a month. Have them come by. So they showed up one morning. Elderly couple, old people. I mean, very old, like in their early 80s. And they were the old man was on a cane. The lady was helping him walk along, and she had this giant bag hanging down. She said, "Okay." I said, "Come on in." And I thought, well, this is such a sweet couple. And out of the bag, she got this big wooden box. I thought, well, this is cool. This is going to be like an antique, and I can do those kinds of things. Highly collectibles, easy. Not a problem at all. Well, she opened the box, and I was kind of my heart kind of fell because it was just a stack of papers, old papers. And she just scoops them out, shaking with her hand. She puts them in front of me. And she said, "What do you see there?" Freaking $10 million gold bonds. 10 of them. 10 million in gold priced at the mark of the maturity date. So in other words, you would convert those to ounces at that price and then take that price forward to what 1996 this was, 1997. Those things were worth billions and billions of dollars. And I thought, this has got to be phony, but they looked authentic, and at the time, the technology wasn't like it was now, but I scanned one, sent it to a guy I knew down in Dallas who was an authenticator of old securities. And we talked. I said, "Well, how did you get these?" And she got them from her deceased German uncle of hers. I guess it was, who had lived in Dusseldorf. He had managed to get up to Finland during the war. And then after the war, he had a lot of money, and he just bought a bunch of these gold bonds. That was her story. And I thought, well, this is a nice story, but they can't be real. I thought, well, the guy is going to fax me back what his opinion is from Dallas. He called me. He said, "What the hell did you find?" And then he started asking me questions. He said, "Look here, look here. Tell me what you see here on one of them." He said, I won't say his more colorful language, but he said, "These could very well be real." And I said, "Let's get them sold." He said, "You're not going to sell these." "Wait, what? No one's going to buy these." "Why not?" "Well, because they're just worth so much, ridiculously much. No one is ever going to touch these. These are like toxic waste." He used the term toxic waste. He said, "Close up the box and buy the old people lunch and let them go. Tell them you can't help them." You got to be able to do this. I mean, he said, "They are so old and they have become so valuable that they basically are like something that doesn't exist." And I said, "Well, is it that the government actually finally canceled anyone who has not honored these yet, can't honor them now?" He said, "No, that was never done." He said, "They are real. They are real gold bonds. But at this level, what is in this, you say there's 10 of them?" "Yeah." He said, "And they're all the same value?" "Yeah." "Well," he said, "there you go." He said, "Yeah, you see why no one's going to touch these with a 10-foot pole. Where would you sell them? What would they do for anyone who would buy it? No one could buy them because there would be nothing that could be done with them. Put them in a frame on a wall. Yeah, look at this thing. It's a real gold bond. This one right here, this one's worth $18 billion. No one's going to touch it." It was one of the most, it's like, I couldn't do anything with them. They died, both of them, they died together in their sleep about a year later. I have no idea what happened to those gold bonds, but they, for all I know, and I'm not an expert on it, but I did have an expert tell me, they were real. So there you go. Such was the world of consulting. Some of the things that were the most outrageous were the things that actually were real. Let me show you something here. Unlike debt from a corporation or from a government entity, consumer debt amortizes over a time period. It will amortize. You're paying off the principal and the interest on that principal with each payment. That's unusual. That is consumer debt. The question would be something along this line. Now, I'm going to start out here. And I'm going to go, I don't know which I trust less. An information repository called Google or an information repository called Yahoo. But anyway, one way or the other. Woman, I want you to give me what's going to be your first really nice new car that you're going to buy? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Is there going to be am I going to get actually a price? Have you ever noticed you try to go to these places and all they do is try to drag you around, get your email address and all that kind of crap? Come on. Price, come on. Oh, God, this pisses me off, these things do. Okay. Price. Okay. Oh, okay. That's a Quattro. Oh, the manual. I am seeing about, maybe you could negotiate it down to $100,000. Okay? $100,000. So you're going to issue a note to a bank. You'll issue it. I will buy the note. I'm the bank. I'll buy the note. Okay, you have made a deal with this young man right here. He's going to buy this car from you in 2 years, and he has agreed to pay you $70,000 for it. 36 months, $70,000. Let's see if this deal works. Watch what I do here. On that nice little financial calculator, and this is some, oh, I'm just testing your ass. There, see? That, really? There. Okay. Okay, first of all, let's set up the payments. 60 months. Oh, I forgot to do an interest rate. You're going to, let's say, get an interest rate of 5.39% APR. Now your effective rate will be a little higher than that. Remember how to do an effective rate. But we'll do 5.39 divided by 12. Remember that you have to make, it's 12 times a year. And then we'll put that in for the interest rate. And the present value, and we're figuring tax and title included, out the door is $100,000. Okay, so that will be your present value. There's no kicker at the end. Your payments, we're going to calculate, compute the payment. Am I seeing that right? That's not that bad. It's a way out of my league, but $1,905. So your payments would be $905.04. You know, if you're in the big leagues, honestly, at maybe $100,000 a year, That's an affordable, that's something that you could probably handle. Okay, so the question though is, if you want to unload this car in 3 years and buy yourself something else, and this guy has agreed to buy it for $70,000. So the next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to hit the amortization table. And I can actually run down through the table and look at the balance. In other words, how much, notice that off the bat, the balance isn't going down too much with each of your payments. You see that early in the life of the loan? Most of it's going to interest. But slowly as the months go on, more and more of each payment goes to the principal because the interest is getting to be a less and less important part. Well, let's go out here to 36 months. So what do you see? Is it a deal? Talk to me. Tell me, up or down? Is the deal with him good? He's going to pay you $70,000. How much do you have to pay the bank? So you pocket $33,000, and there's your down payment on your next Audi. You get the idea? That's one of the greatest things you can do with an amortization table, is you can see how your balance falls. It also gives you one of the best ways to see when you are right side up on your loan. Right side up means when the value of the asset goes above the balance you owe. You are upside down on a car when you drive it off the lot. Right away, you're upside down because you lose value as you drive it off the lot. And then you are crawling out of that hole, and finally you go right side up. The same is on a home mortgage. And those are even more brutal because in a home mortgage, it is just ridiculous how little of each payment in the first years is actually going to bring down the balance on the house. And so if that house slips a little bit, you're going to be upside down on that house. If your neighborhood, the character of your neighborhood starts to change, one reason for zoning is you try to keep having your neighborhood go to hell. Because if it goes to hell, the value of your house goes down, and you might have been right side up, and suddenly you find one day, because I've moved into your neighborhood with my double wide trailer from Decatur and my three dogs that have 9 legs among them. Lost legs and like we were hungry, barbecue and all that. And I have my picket fence with my beer cans up on it. You don't want that because that's going to drive your house down in value. You might end up upside down on your house when you were right side up the night before I moved in. That's why you try to hold that value. On your car, when you buy a new car, have you ever owned a new car? You have a new car? Were you one of those people like me, when someone would pull up next to it, you would stand there and stare at them? Don't you even dream of opening your car door. You crawl out through the window, sucker. Every morning you go out there like that and dust it off. You're worried about that car because every scratch, every ding, every nick, every cloud of fart that goes over it drops its value. Yeah, you are climbing out of a pit. You're upside down off the bat. Let me show you how serious it is with a house. Let's say that you get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, and let's say that you can pull 4.99% APR on it, and monthly payments, the standard stuff, and you are going to take out a loan for $200,000. On that. One problem that's going to hit you right off the bat is that when you get out a loan, well, I want to borrow $200,000. The problem is that you are not going to actually get a loan for $200,000. They are going to assess fees and they're going to assess points. And by the time it's over with, you might, let's say that you got a house that was worth $220,000. 10% down puts it at $200,000. And that's what you're going to get the loan for. But you won't get the loan for that. You're going to pay fees. Let's say that between fees and title and points, $5,000. So you'll actually get a loan for that amount of money there. That's what they'll hit you with. Now remember, you've got a house. This is its value. Right here. You put your 10% down, you've gotten out a loan for $205,000. Now let's clear this out. And let's do 30 years divided by 12. So that'd be 360 payments. And your interest rate is 4.99 APR divided by 12. And we'll put that in for the interest. And you are going to get a loan for $205,000. I keep forgetting to put in the negative. Okay, now, compute your payment. My ass, what did I do wrong there? $360 periods. And compute the payment. Oh, $852.46 a month. $852.46. By the way, interesting thing. Study was done, it's been maybe about 6-8 years ago. Audit bank survey was done by some academics who found out that fully 30% of all of the loans that had been issued by banks in a certain region of the country had a payment that was too high based on the calculation. It doesn't hurt for you to know how to do the calculation. 30% of the loans that had been issued over a period of maybe 5 years had the payment incorrect. And not once was the payment too low. In every case, the payment was too high. So there's a cautionary tale why it might be worth your while to know this. Okay, so now, let me get that amortization table up here again. What did I do with the number of periods? 360. Why does it keep doing that? Oh, clear. Dang. Start from the beginning. 360 is N. 4.99 divided by 12 is your I over Y. Your present value is 205,000. Pause neg, present value. Compute the payments. You know what? What am I doing wrong here? Okay. There. Nah, no, I refuse to refresh a page. Refreshing a page is for wusses. That looks right. Yeah, I did a perpetuity there. Jeez, boy. Okay, now let's do the amortization. Okay. Look at that. You just put $1,100, and what did you get for that in terms of the balance reduction? About $247 of balance reduction. $247,000. Now notice then that your house is worth $220,000. Notice how long it's going to take for you to really clear. Let's say that you want to get to a loan-to-value ratio that is less than 80%, so you can get that mortgage insurance off. Remember I told you about that mortgage insurance? At 80%, you can get that off. So 80% of $205,000 would be about $182,000, something like that. See how long it gets you so that you can get that off your back. Yeah, it's up here. Right around here, in that area right there, 76 months, what is that, 5 years, 6 years out, you can go to the bank and get your mortgage insurance taken off. That'll make your payment go down some because they'll have to recompute your loan payments. Or you can have them just shorten the life of the loan, one way or the other. You can have that taken off your loan right then and there. But you have to, that's financial planning. Okay, 6 years out, I'm going to be able, my payments will not be as large on this. But I've got to keep in mind that I got to remember to go to the bank and tell them I need this done at that point in time. Now, here's an interesting thing that's going to, you'll see. If you were to look at the principal against time, the longer the life of your loan, the shallower is going to be that drop, I'm sorry. Let me do it the other way. Let's see. The balance. I'll say it that way. It's only way out there that the loan drops hard. The balance starts to go really steep at about, in a 30-year loan, about year, honestly, you really start to notice the balance dropping rapidly at about year 15 to 18. Now, interestingly, if you can handle the payments, a 20-year loan would have a remarkably steeper drop-off. In other words, if you can handle higher payments, the payoff to you is that you have less risk of ever getting upside down on the loan and then being stuck with the loan, stuck with the house, and you don't want that anymore. The same is true with auto loans. If you were to compute just the difference between a 60-month loan, 5-year, and a 4-year loan, 48 months, you would be surprised at how it looks the same profile. You're out, that car's value, that car, the balance you owe drops really more steeply. With a 60-month loan, you really begin to see the balance dropping at about 36 to 40 months. But with a 36-month loan, you see the balance starting to drop really fast, no more than 18 to 20 months out. And that's why it's always a good idea if you can handle the higher payments. And of course, you might not. It's so attractive. Yeah, 60 months, those are small payments. I can handle that. But if you think about it in a slightly longer term context, that's why if you get 36-month loans on cars and handle the payments, you can trade your car in every 24 months and you're right side up on it. You can drive a new car every 2 years if you could handle a 36-month loan on a car. Because you are right side up so fast on that, you've got equity in your car in time for you to have a new one every 2 years. And that's how some people do it. They just, if you get into that habit of doing the shorter loans, you'll find that you can renew your asset much more rapidly than people like me. I'm still driving a car that is a 2009, but it's not as bad as you. You're driving a car that's a 1983. No, you're not. But anyway, okay, there is how you do amortization, and that's all I have for you today. I thank you.